Accession number 29702, reel number 1.
And so, my first duty, and I'll try and keep this preamble to a minimum, is to welcome you all and say how good it is to see you here, and to mention just one or two names. And when I do this, I apologize to other people, and there are many among you who are worthy of mention, but I think you would like to know that we have with us today two men of the very, very elite among American servicemen, two holders of the Congressional Medal of Honor, both members of the 8th Air Force, and it doesn't need me to tell you that of all those Medal of Honors won in World War II, the 8th Air Force and the air forces that supported it took nearly half the Medal of Honors, which says something to the bloody war that they were mixed up in. We have Edward Michael and William Lawley of the 305th Bomb Group, who both won and readily deserved that award. We also have with us Merle Olmsted, who represents the esteemed American Aviation Historical Society. Merle was also a member of the 8th Air Force. He was one of the guys that kept the Mustangs of the 357th Group going to war. He's an author and an esteemed historian, and we welcome him too. I'd also like to mention just two other names that I noticed on the list. One is Joseph Thurry of the 339th Group, a very brave man. He was one of the top strafing aces of the 8th Air Force. Welcome to him. And I'd like to mention Bill Thorns, who flew top turret on the lead plane to both Swinefort and Regensburg with LeMay. I don't have to tell you what sort of a mission that was. I also note and welcome to them that we have members of the 12th Air Force and the 9th Air Force here. Very pleased to see you. Now I come to the panel. I'm going to start in a rather haphazard way because I just don't know what are the priorities. But there is one priority, because the first person I'm going to introduce is a legend in his own time. General Adolf Galland flew just about every sort of Luftwaffe fighter in World War II, and he was flying at the start and flying at the end. As I said, he's a legend. I don't really have to say any more. But I will say this, that an old RAF friend of his said to me when I told him that General Galland would be the only representative of the Luftwaffe up here on the panel. And I queried whether this was fair on General Galland. And his RAF friend said, "Don't worry, he's more than able to take care of himself, and all the rest of you as well." Right at the end, on my left, is Major General Philip Ardrey, who wrote a super book called Bomber Pilot. He was a B-24 man, and I don't really have to say much about his combat experience except one word, Ploiesti. There were not an awful lot of guys who came back from that raid. And he will keep up the B-24 Liberator end of the discussion today. But don't worry, all you fortress boys, because we have Major General John, better known as Jack Houston, who was a navigator, dare I say it, in one of the most successful B-17 groups in the 8th Air Force. But he has another claim to fame. He was, for a number of years, chief of the USAF Office of History, and he retired this year. And as far as I am aware, he is the last general officer in the USAF who had combat service in the 8th Air Force to retire. So he has made history himself, if I haven't muddled that up. Thank you. course, I forgot to tell you which was Major General Houston, but I thought you'd know he was the good-looking young one. He's second on my left. Now, on the right, at the far end, we have Richard Peterson. When I was a boy of 16, one day I saw a Mustang with a red and yellow check nose come hurtling over one of my father's fields, and through my binoculars, which were illegal at that time in Britain to have, I managed to see as it went by the nickname Hurry Home Honey. I don't know who was flying it, but I know that the aeroplane now belonged to Richard Peterson, one of the leading aces in the 357th Fighter Group, the first Mustang fighter group that the 8th Air Force had, a very distinguished pilot, and we're very pleased to have him here. And last, but far, far from least, is a youngster called Cass Huff, here on my right. Well, Cass is 77, and I know he won't object to me stating his age because he just doesn't look it. But what I think is extraordinary is that he celebrated his 77th birthday by making his 60th flight. He's been flying for 60 years. Now that really is something. In World War II, in the 8th Air Force, Cass was what we British call a boffin. When you boys had troubles with the B-17s and the B-24s and the fighters and the things that they carried, he sorted them out. But amongst his many achievements, the thing which I think stands out above everything else is that he had major responsibility for the development of a pressurized drop tank that enabled the fighters to go all the way with the bombers. That was a war-winning invention. Cass Huff. I said I'd be brief. Did you ever know a limey who could shut up? Well, very quickly, the subject. You know what the subject is. We're going to discuss the 8th Air Force and its conflict with the Luftwaffe. But I make one point, and I stress it. This is history. Okay, you fellas were all mixed up in it, but it was a long, long time ago. There have been a couple of generations since then. There are kids today who ask, who was Adolf Hitler? Who was Winston Churchill? Yes, that's so. We're dealing with history today. There are no recriminations, no national bias. We're only after the truth, and the truth you shall have, I'm sure. Well, as you know, the British and the Germans had tried daylight bombing operations and had found them extremely costly. The Americans thought that they knew better than either of those other nations and decided to give it a go in 1942. So my lead-off question, and I will put this to General Gallen, is, had the Luftwaffe any idea of the type of operations, bombing operations, the Americans were going to undertake from England? Did they expect them to be successful? And did they think that they would be able to deal with them when they experienced the first few early raids in 1942?
The answer is yes, we had knowledge about the appearance of American four-engine day bombers. We knew that they did arrive in England, and we expected their attacks beginning in late 42, I think. At this time, German Luftwaffe was in a very bad position. The war against Russia has started in the middle of 41, and all but two fighter wings had been displaced to the Russian front. So our strength in the West in the area of the first attacks of the B-17s was about 60 fighter aircraft divided in two main bases, one more to the south and one to the north. One of these was my former fighter wing 26, and the other one was fighter wing 2 Richthofen. Our fighter pilots had difficulties with the B-17s and the B-24s right from the beginning. We didn't expect and we didn't have knowledge about the armament, about the strength of the armament, and about the tactics. But we knew when the 8th Air Force would have continued without fighter protection, then one or the other day we would have overcome these problems. So we learned on the subject. The targets of first attacks were bases close to the coast, and the incursions came in at a very, very high altitude, and they disappeared very soon, so it really did give us a short time to fight against them. But the situation has changed later on dramatically.
Thank you, General. Cass, I know that at that time, in 42, you were primarily concerned with fighter operations, but I wonder if you have any observations on the early American high-level bombing operations, in fact, American operations in general from England in 42. By that I mean, what was the assessment of the opposition that would be met, and did you think that you could overcome this reasonably easily, or did you think it was going to be very difficult? Were you influenced by what the RAF told you? Would you like to have a go at that?
No, I wouldn't, but I'll try. We were obviously influenced by what the RAF told us. Our own Air Force, as you know, were confident that the B-17s and the B-24s could defend themselves against any type of opposition, that the armament aboard was sufficient, that they needed no fighter cover. Well, for those of us who were fighter jockeys at the time had been taught that bombers really couldn't, without fighter cover, do the kind of job they should and come back. This was almost heresy, but we had to accept it. Roger, speaking specifically to the question of the early raids, the word came down through from headquarters, of course, that with the kind of losses, not the first two or three, but maybe up in the 20th, 25th raid, the word came down through that with losses that were beginning to occur then, that the 8th Air Force, nor any Air Force for that matter, could long keep itself in the air successfully without fighter cover. And of course that brought up the question of how are we going to do it.
I know our B-17 and B-24 panelists were not in action in those very early days. Well, I beg their pardon if they were, but I don't know whether they would like to add anything to that.
See if this thing works. No. It's not working. Go ahead to your next
one. No, you can't get away just because you don't like to walk up here.
Thank you, Roger. I do believe, and maybe, Cass, you know a good deal more about this than I do, but I think there was a considerable controversy in the beginning as to whether or not the United States Air Force was going to be able to sustain those daylight raids. And it was the contention of the RAF that the heavy bombers, the USAF, ought to be sort of funneled into their command, because they said you'll never be able to make it in the daytime. The losses will be too heavy. And General Gallen was one of those who was assigned the responsibility to see that it was too heavy. And I might say that he is much handsomer without his oxygen mask. General Houston.
Yeah, I think this controversy is a serious one. There's no doubt when our acre went over in February with seven other people, Bernie Lay, Fred Castle, Harris Hull, that there's no doubt that Bomber Harris felt, I think, that the Americans could be converted to nighttime operations. Remember, we had no theory of daylight or even nighttime bombardment. There's no doubt, for instance, Harris entertained Acker, insisted the headquarters be there very close by as they worked together there in at Pine Tree. And I think there was a real question which wasn't resolved, I don't think, until Arnold came over in late spring of 1942 and finally worked out the deal with the airfields, which we were taking over from the RAF. And up till then, I think the British made a very strong effort to attempt to get the Americans and to join them in nighttime operations. One thing from a historical perspective, bear in mind, remember that you and I and the rest up here, we're only the second generation of people to fly. In other words, remember that it had only been 30-odd years since the Wright brothers had flown. And as a result, all of this then is going to evolve. There's little or no technique. There's no idea, back in the Cass's portion, comment about the type of equipment you're going to need. And I guess maybe this is one of the greatest learning experiences we're ever going to see in the military, to learn, back to Gerald Gallen's comment, how to do this. And bear in mind, then, you're only the second generation to fly. Arnold, for instance, had been taught to fly by the Wright brothers. Our Acre had only learned to fly in 1917. And you only remember 15 years after Lindbergh had flown across the Atlantic. So I think you ought to put that in the historical perspective. Sorry to wander a bit, Roger.
No, I think that was valid. Okay, so we've looked at the ideas, the theories of daylight strategic bombardment as the United States Army Air Force intended to perform it back in 42. Now this leads us to the actual air battles in those early days. And I should stress, and it's remiss of me that I didn't mention this earlier on, that this first session will take us through the period when the unescorted daylight bombers were in operation, up to late 43. The second session will deal with the period towards the end of the war when the American escort fighters became more effective. This leads us to these air battles, these furious air battles between the unescorted bombers, or generally unescorted bombers, and the Luftwaffe. And there's some interesting points here. I'd like to ask General Gallen what the general tactics in the early days were for attacking B-17s or B-24s. And was it necessary to modify these tactics in view of the experience of the early attacks? Did they find the defensive armament of the B-17s and B-24s very effective? They certainly must have been far superior to the very poor armament of the RAF bombers of those days. In fact, generally, how did the form of attack develop on the American formations? And what moves were made in the early months of 1943 to improve these tactics? Would you like to have a go at that, sir?
I'm trying to answer this from this position. I mentioned before the German Air Force did have only at disposal in the West two wings, with an operational strength of about daily 60 aircraft. These were mainly 109s. Up to this point,
we didn't have experience, practical experience, only a little bit gained in 1941 when the Royal Air Force came over to France and did attack our airfields. They came with Spitfires and Hurricanes as escorts, but the Blenheims, which were mainly used by the Royal Air Force, were very lightly defended. You could neglect completely the defense of a Blenheim, but not the escort fighter. So when the 8th Air Force came in with the four-engine bombers, the situation has changed completely. And suppose we would have had at our disposal 10 or 12 wings instead of 2, this D-ranked attempt without escort would have finished immediately. This for sure. We had to change our tactics because we were used to attack one behind the other coming in. But in order to divide the protective fire of the bombers, we needed an attacking front. So we trained this. And we found out that very soon Spitfires were escorting the bombers, which came in very high altitude. And we had an additional problem now. And this problem has been increased from month to month. And we will come to the point when I will confess that nothing has shown and has presented such a shock to the German fighter and to the German Air Force as the 8th Air Force. One of the most intelligent things was that the decision between the English and the American Air Force, between the Royal Air Force and the American Air Force, American Army Air Force at the time, was to divide the operation in night operations with all the sophisticated specialism they needed, and in day operation, which very soon were clear that they could be performed only with escort fighters. More about this a little bit later.
Thank you, General. But leading on to that, can I ask you two other questions which I'm sure will interest people? The defensive fire of the American bombers, the .50 caliber machine gun, was it very effective? Were many German fighters hit in those early attacks by defensive fire? And which was the most dangerous defensive position to approach on the American bombers? In the tail or where?
The defensive fire was very active and very effective, especially when the formation, the bomber formation, were flying very close together, and when they didn't open the formation, one bomber by his own was lost completely. But if so long as they stand in close formation, the concentrated fire backwards. Backwards means from the heck.
Tail turret.
Tail turret, thank you. And from the tarpon. This was the most effective one. To the side, the fire was not very effective. You could neglect this. An attack consists in the approach, in the combat phase, when you are firing, and in the place when you have to disappear. We found out that the best manner to disappear was to go very, very close to the bomber, on top or below, and then to disappear to altitude and continue with the next attack. But the problem was our fighters had to learn to attack simultaneously in a line. And this was not so easy to convince the pilots, because they may select the same target. And if they get closer, the danger is coming up that they will hit each other. But when we were close to know what to do, then the next difficulty appeared with the fighter escort. My position at this time was general of the fighter command. I was, between others, responsible for the combat advices, for the combat orders. And I have handwritten these orders, which were typed, of course, later on, by myself. This was one of my main obligations. And therefore, I had to go to the units, to my fighter units, and to talk to the people. I was not allowed to fly in combat, even so I did it later on. But I could only learn from their experience how to make it better. And we also at this time discovered that a bomber formation can be attacked from the front, can be successfully attacked, especially when this formation is not escorted. The defensive fire to the front is not very effective. You could about neglect it. It is compared to the aggressive fire of the fighters top on top, that is inferior.
Thank you, General. Well, this leads us to the claims by the gunners on the B-17s and B-24s in the opening months of the conflict. And it was a very controversial issue. I can remember as a kid my father saying, "Well, you can't believe what these Yanks claim. They exaggerated everything." But, no, you shouldn't clap. You should be very cross. I'm sure that somewhere in this room there are gunners who honestly thought they'd shot down a German fighter. And quite probably they did not, but they believed at the time that they did. Now, this is an interesting thing, because I think that the majority of claims were made in all good faith. So I'd like to ask, I think we'll start with General Ardrey, would you like to give us your explanation why these high claims occurred?
Let me see if this... I don't think this is working. I'm going to try it. All right, I'll get up here. How about it? Does this work now? Roger, I'd like to answer that, of course, but I'd like first to comment just a word on what the General has had to say, because I find his comment so fascinating. It's difficult to me to concentrate on what I'm going to say. But one of the thoughts that was expressed often by the B-24 pilots, and I think it was a word that passed around the 8th Air Force, and many of you have heard it, was that the B-17 jockeys, that they didn't care whether they had fighter escort or not as long as the B-24s went along.
If I may interrupt, sir, the reason they picked a Limey for the job in the middle was to stop any conflict between B-17 and B-24.
Well, that's fair, but I think still it's a part of the record, it's a part of the history. And I think that it's worthy of some comment that our aircraft, whether we are loyal to them or not, were not as good above 20,000 feet, and there were problems that we had that necessitated defensive measures, perhaps made the Luftwaffe seek out the B-24s a little bit. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Now, I was terribly afraid of the head-on attacks, and I thought that it was just a question of whether the guy wanted to make a head-on attack rather than whether he was trained to do that sort of thing and briefed to do that sort of thing. But the devastating attacks that we got sometimes, the most devastating, were those where the attacking fighters, the ME-109s in the early days, would come up from the front and roll over and fire when they were in inverse position and try, obviously, to knock out the lead and deputy lead aircraft, because if they had a heavy box of bombers and they could knock out the lead and deputy lead, the whole thing would just break open like a rotten watermelon and it would come apart. And that appeared to me to be the most dangerous tactic that the Luftwaffe had. So I thought that was the gravest danger that we had. Now, Roger, I'm sorry, I spread this thing around a little bit. Give me your question again just a minute, and I'll make a brief answer.
That was pertinent, very interesting. In fact, if any other members of the panel want to comment on the Luftwaffe tactics in the early days,